Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. Today I'll be talking to Professor Anthony Chalmers, who is the Chair of Clinical Oncology at the University of Glasgow, and is also Chair of the NCRI CT-RAD Working Group. His research is focused on improving outcomes in glioblastoma. He has written an excellent Science in Focus article, which was published in our journal earlier this year, looking at combining radiotherapy with inhibitors of the DNA damage response. And I started our interview off by asking, what actually is the DNA damage response?
So this is something that has evolved in all cells to enable them to deal with the damage that naturally occurs to DNA all the time, mostly as a result of chemicals or molecular species that actually are generated within cells, for example, as byproducts of respiration or metabolism, but also to protect cells against damage from agents outside of cells. So, for example, ultraviolet light or naturally occurring radiation, radioactive elements that are present in the environment. So essentially, the DNA in cells are constantly bombarded by different types of damaging agents. So cells have evolved quite complex mechanisms, firstly to recognize when DNA has been damaged by whatever cause, and then to be able to repair that damage. Because obviously the integrity of the DNA sequence and the DNA structure is extremely important, both in terms of cells functioning and surviving from day to day, but perhaps more importantly, trying to prevent cells acquiring mutations which could be damaging, particularly in terms of a risk of carcinogenesis. So the DNA damage response is an innate component of every living cell. It's very relevant to cancer treatment because the vast majority of cytotoxic treatments that we use to treat cancer work by damaging the DNA of cancer cells. So this DNA damage response, which has evolved to protect cells from naturally occurring damage, also turns out to be really important when we treat cancer.
So your article talks about targeting the DNA damage response in cancers. So why should we be doing that?
The broad reason is that one of the reasons that we fail to cure cancer when we treat it with DNA damaging agents is that the cancer cells are able to repair quite a large proportion of the DNA damage that our treatments inflict. And so a significant proportion of the cancer cells survive those treatments, and that's why the treatments fail. So in very simple terms, if we can inhibit the DNA damage response, we can make it less likely that cancer cells repair the DNA damage that's induced by our treatments, and therefore a higher proportion of the cancer cells will die, and therefore we have a higher chance of curing the tumor. So that's the basic premise, but obviously we have to consider the normal tissues as well. So when we treat patients with either chemotherapy or radiotherapy, we expose normal tissues to DNA damage as well. And if we were just to wipe out the DNA damage response globally, then we would obviously be no better off because we'd be damaging the normal tissues just as much as we're damaging the cancer cells. So what my lab team and many others are trying to do is to identify which components of the DNA damage response are particularly important in tumor cells compared with normal tissue cells, and then target those so that we increase the percentage of cancer cells that we kill without increasing the effects on the normal tissues.
So what you've been talking about implies that the DNA damage response may be different in cancers from normal tissues. Is that the case? And in very simple terms then, how is the DNA damage response different in cancers?
So so to explain that, I first need to describe the DNA damage response in a bit more detail. So there are two major components to it. One is DNA repair. So these are the proteins that recognize damaged DNA and then work together to actually physically and chemically repair the DNA molecules and trying to retain the integrity of the DNA molecules. The second component is the cell cycle checkpoint network, and this is a system whereby when cells recognize DNA damage, they activate cell cycle checkpoints which stop cells from proliferating. Most importantly, they stop cells from replicating damaged DNA, because replication of damaged DNA creates more complex and more damaging lesions. And also it stops cells from attempting to actually divide in the presence of damaged DNA. So it stops cells from entering mitosis. So those are the two major components. In terms of are they different in cancer cells than normal cells? Well, the answer is absolutely yes. If we think about cell cycle checkpoints first, the G1S checkpoint is the major cell cycle checkpoint in all normal tissue cells, and it's very effective, and it's predominantly controlled by ATM and also P53. And except for a few very rare cases where there's a germline defect in one of those key proteins, the normal tissues of all of our patients will have a very robust G1S checkpoint. If you then think about cancer cells, the vast majority of cancer cells have lost that G1S checkpoint control. And in many cases, that's because they have mutant or null P53. And this is one of the reasons why cells become malignant, is because they lose the cell cycle checkpoint control. So P53 mutations is a really classic example of that. If we think about DNA repair, it's a little more complicated and a little bit less well understood, but there are some very clear examples where DNA repair machinery is abnormal in cancer cells. The most well-known example is in breast or ovarian cancer cells, which have lost function of either BRCA1 or BRCA2, both of which are key proteins in the homologous recombination DNA repair pathway. And there are lots of other examples, which aren't as common as that, where specific DNA repair proteins are mutated or underexpressed in cancer. And probably very many more examples where there isn't a complete loss of any one particular protein, but the pathways as a whole don't function properly. We don't fully understand that yet. But we know it happens in cancer, because if you look at levels of DNA damage in cancer cells, they're generally much, much, much higher than they are in normal tissue cells. So clearly, something's going wrong in those cancer cells in terms both of generating DNA damage, but also failing to repair it properly. So we are very confident that there are multiple defects in the DNA damage response in cancer cells. We know a lot about the cell cycle checkpoint defects, and we know less about the DNA repair defects, but we know that they both occur.
Thank you. You explained a very complex area very clearly there. So I wanted to go on to one of the flagship drugs, as you were, that have been used to target the DNA damage response, PARP inhibitors. You mentioned them in your article. So can you tell us a bit more about them and how they work?
Sure. So PARP, that's poly-ADP ribose polymerase, is a very abundant nuclear protein that plays an important role in the basic scission repair pathway. And basic scission repair is responsible for nearly all of the repair of DNA single-strand breaks, particularly those induced by radiotherapy. Now, single-strand breaks alone are less damaging to the cell than double-strand breaks. So if you inhibit PARP in a non-replicating cell and then irradiate that cell, you have very little impact. and that's because the cell can use other repair proteins or pathways to repair some of those single-stranded breaks. And even if it doesn't repair them completely, they're not particularly damaging to the cell. But in contrast, if you inhibit PARP in a cell that is actively replicating its DNA and then you irradiate that cell, then you firstly prevent or reduce the efficiency of the single-strand break repair. But because the DNA is being replicated, those unrepaired single-strand breaks get converted into double-strand breaks, which are very toxic to the cell. So in essence, if you combine radiotherapy and a PARP inhibitor, you increase cell kill, but only of replicating cells. So clearly this gives you an element of tumor specificity because the tumor cells are generally rapidly proliferating. And certainly when you think about late responding normal tissues, which are often the dose-limiting tissues, then we predict there will actually be no effect of PARP inhibitors on radiosensitivity of those late responding tissues because they are made up almost entirely of non-proliferating cells. So that's why I and several other researchers are very excited about combining radiotherapy with PARP inhibitors.
And in terms of clinical trials with PARP inhibitors, is there much going on in the UK and beyond?
Yes. So of all the DNA damage response targets, PARP is the one that's the most advanced. And this is partly because PARP inhibitors have been around for a long time and there are some very good compounds that are already on the market and have already been given to patients. So there are a number of clinical trials of radiotherapy in combination with PARP inhibitors, some in the UK, some overseas, and most of them are in phase one stage. So dose escalating the PARP inhibitor to find out what the best dose is and the best schedule to combine with radiotherapy. And phase one studies are underway in lung cancer, head and neck cancer, glioblastoma, esophageal cancer, to name just a few. What's quite interesting in terms of clinical trial design and what's made it quite complicated to design these clinical trials is that in most cases, the standard of care for the tumors that are being evaluated is radiotherapy in combination with a chemotherapy agent. So for example, cisplatin in head and neck cancer or lung cancer, temozolomide for glioblastoma. So it's been a little bit tricky to design a phase one study where you can test the effect of the PARP inhibitor on the radiotherapy, but also deal with any potential interactions with the chemotherapy component. And I should just point out that PARP inhibitors increase the cytotoxic effects of quite a lot of different chemotherapy drugs, including the ones I've just mentioned. And because both PARP inhibitors and chemotherapy drugs are given systemically, that often goes along with an increase in systemic toxicity, for example, bone marrow toxicity. So that has made clinical trial design a little bit more complicated. And so different people have approached that in different ways. So for example, in our study in glioblastoma, we've started off in elderly patients who don't receive temozolomide as standard of care. So we are combining radiotherapy with the PARP inhibitor, olaparib, without the complicating factor of the chemotherapy. But then some other studies in lung cancer or head and neck cancer are taking a different approach and are incorporating the cisplatin component right from the beginning, which has necessitated a very cautious approach in terms of dose escalation of the PARP inhibitor. But I'm happy to say that progress has been made using both of those different approaches, and we are beginning to understand better how to combine PARP inhibitors with radiotherapy and chemotherapy in the most effective and the safest way.
I guess it's important to stress at this point, you've been talking about PARP inhibitors in combination with radiation with cancers that aren't necessarily BRCA deficient, which is where PARP inhibitors initially found their role. So are you getting similar kind of response rates to what we're seeing in that context?
Thank you for asking me that, because this is a really common misunderstanding. So when PARP inhibitors are used as single agents, they only work against cancers that have quite a profound DNA repair defect, and that's most classically the BRCA1 or BRCA2 deficient cancers. And in that scenario, PARP inhibitors are often being used as maintenance therapy after standard cytotoxic chemotherapy treatments. So, for example, ovarian cancer, where olaparib has been licensed, it's used as a long-term maintenance treatment. In contrast, if you're combining PARP inhibitors with radiotherapy, we don't think you need to identify or restrict your study to cancers which have a DNA repair defect. We believe that any replicating tumor cells will be radiosensitized by the PARP inhibitor. Now, having said that, some of the other work we've done in our lab and other labs around the world have shown that if cells have a DNA repair defect, or indeed some cell cycle checkpoint defects, then your radiosensitizing benefit is greater. So that's another way that we think we're going to get a tumor-specific radiosensitizing effect, because, as I mentioned back at the beginning, most cancers do have some kind of DNA repair defect. But it seems that that DNA repair defect doesn't need to be a profound one or a genetically inherited one. We still think there'll be a benefit from the PARP inhibitors when you combine it with radiotherapy.
And with regards to PARP inhibitors that were used in BRCA-deficient tumors, a fair amount is known about mechanisms of resistance. But looking at it in combination with radiation, do you anticipate you'd see the same kind of things, or are you seeing anything at all yet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we don't know, because we haven't got the wealth of experience that we now have with PARP inhibitors as single agents. But there are some really important differences. So when you're using PARP inhibitors as single agents, you're giving it chronically to patients over months or even years. And most of the studies show that resistance emerges after a period of months or years of chronic treatment. What we're doing in our radiotherapy combinations is really just giving a short burst of more intensive therapy by combining our PARP inhibitor with the radiotherapy regime. So typically maybe a 6 or 7 week course of treatment, after which there's no indication that you need to carry on treating with your PARP inhibitor. So really it's a different aim, which is to increase the effectiveness of each fraction of radiotherapy during that treatment course. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but I would expect the risk of developing resistance during that acute period of treatment is much lower than during a chronic extended period of single agent dosing. Now, obviously, we will have to wait and see whether that turns out to be the case, but I think the resistance mechanisms that have been identified for the single agent treatments occur in a very different way than we are anticipating the combinations treatments will work.
And we've been talking about PARP inhibitors, but in your article you mentioned several other classes of DDR inhibitors that will hopefully be entering the arena soon. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of inhibitors, both of DNA repair proteins and of cell cycle checkpoint proteins, that are just beginning to come into the clinic now. And the exciting aspect about those drugs is that they are quite a bit more potent than PARP inhibitors in terms of their radiosensitizing ability. So traditionally, a PARP inhibitor would increase the radiosensitivity of a tumor cell population by about 30 to 50%. So what we call a sensitizer enhancement ratio of between 1.3 and 1.5. And in simple terms, that would be equivalent to increasing the radiation dose by about 50%. Whereas some of the newer inhibitors are increasing radiosensitivity by factors of 2 or greater. So there is potential for perhaps a much more profound radiosensitizing effect. Now, obviously, that raises the concern that there might be collateral damage. And I think with the PARP inhibitors, there's been a lot of work to identify and then confirm the tumor specificity that I've been talking about. With the other inhibitors, so ATM inhibitors, ATR inhibitors, DMAPK inhibitors, WEE1 inhibitors, there are a lot of theoretical explanations which would predict tumor specificity, but I don't think they've been studied in quite as much detail, so we don't necessarily have quite as much confidence in them. But nonetheless, so ATM and ATR inhibitors act predominantly during S phase and at the G2M checkpoint, so we would predict that they wouldn't have much impact at all on normal tissue cells which have an intact G1S checkpoint. I mentioned in the article about DNAPK inhibitors, which do have effects on cells in G1 phase by inhibiting non-homologous end joining, and I personally am a bit worried that those drugs will have radiosensitizing effects on normal tissues. But I think it's early days, and you know, the next couple of years we'll probably find out quite a lot more about how potent those new compounds are in both animal models and in patients, and we will hopefully also get a feeling for whether they are truly tumor-specific. But if they do turn out to be tumor-specific, then I think they're extremely exciting because you could potentially increase the tumor control rates or local control by factors of 2 or even more, which would potentially make a difference in survival.
On a broader level then, combining targeted drugs or any kind of cytotoxic drug really with radiation, there's a lot of clinical trials looking at that in early phase trials, but are there any major challenges to that?
There are loads of challenges. I think that's why we don't have more of these combinations in the clinic. One of the challenges is that pharmaceutical companies in general have been quite reluctant to support radiotherapy drug combinations. And this is partly because, by their very nature, pharmaceutical companies tend not to have a great deal of radiotherapy expertise. I think there also have been concerns that you might cause an increase in normal tissue toxicity, be it acute toxicity or late toxicity. And so that's put some pharma companies off. Once your drugs become available to use in combination with radiotherapy, then there are issues about designing the trial. So you have to decide what's your radiotherapy dose going to be. Is it going to be your standard dose that you would use for radical treatment? Are you going to include the chemotherapy component that might be standard of care? Are you going to do a phase 1 trial in newly diagnosed, radically treated patients? And if you do that, are you risking severe toxicity when you add your drug? So there have been a lot of complications and challenges to designing the trials, choosing the right patients, choosing the radiotherapy standard that you're going to combine your drug with. And I think all these things have sort of held back this field for many years. But I think now we've got much more of a consensus about what is a sensible way to evaluate these combinations, which patient populations are sensible to treat in a phase 1 trial, and how you can think about dose escalation in a safe but meaningful way. So again, quite a long-winded answer, but I think, you know, it has been very challenging, but through kind of consensus and lots of discussions between basic scientists, pharmaceutical companies, clinical oncologists, we have come up with some really, I think, very nice clinical trial designs now, which I hope will give us some good data within the next year or two.
So, Anthony, on that note of optimism, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much for explaining such a complex area so well. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and look out for our next podcast, which features an interview with Professor Hardeep Panda about oncolytic viral therapy in the treatment of cancer.